Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today trial and appellate lawyer extraordinaire Reagan Simpson, who is someone who's known to many appellate lawyers around the bar and a lot of trial lawyers too. Reagan has been a great friend and mentor to folks across the bar, and I can count myself as among those because Reagan was the head of the appellate practice section at Fulbright and Dworky when I started my career as a young lawyer there way back in 1997. Reagan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
We're excited to have you, and we asked you to come on today because we're starting what may turn into a series of episodes dealing with different practice perspectives or different settings in which one may practice appellate law. And we thought you would be a great person to have on to talk about practice in private civil law firms. And by that, we're talking about, you know, really anything to do on the civil side from solo to big firm. And we just happen to have a pretty good representation here on the call today, talk about those issues from those different perspectives. Before we launch into the substance, though, tell us a little bit about your background. I know a good bit of it, as I suggest earlier, but just for everyone else's benefit, tell us about how you came up as a lawyer and where you started your career and kind of overview real quickly your career.
Sure. Well, I've been doing this for 42 years now, been doing it for quite a while. I went to University of Texas Law School, and then I clerked for Tom G. on the Fifth Circuit, who was a great appellate judge, but he was also a great trial lawyer. So learned a lot from Judge G. And after that, I never thought I would go to Houston, but I met a Houston girl. I ended up going to Houston and spending the rest of my career there. And so I've been in Houston, Texas, except for a fairly short time when I was one of your neighbors, Todd, in Austin for a few years with Yetter Coleman. I was at Fulbright Jaworski for 24 years. I started off as a trial lawyer and did commercial litigation and then primarily focused on tort litigation for a long time. Spent a lot of time in South Texas, which is an interesting place to try lawsuits. And when Roger Townsend, a great appellate lawyer here in Texas, left Fulbright Jaworski, they asked me if I would take over. I had already been board certified in civil appellate law for quite some time. And so Wendell Hall and I actually were co-head of the appellate group there at Fulbright for a number of years. Then when I reached about the age 50, I got enticed to go over to King & Spalding in the Houston office and was there for quite a while. And they asked me to go to Austin and open up the Austin office of King & Spalding, which I did, except that during that time, I ended up being a trial lawyer again in Illinois, trying Livy Mizo cases for about 7 years and then handling appeals in the Illinois Courts of Appeals and eventually the Illinois Supreme Court. And I decided I didn't want to become an Illinois lawyer for the rest of my life. I came back to Austin and then I had the opportunity, unfortunately, the opportunity to go to Yetter Coleman after Greg Coleman's death in his plane crash on Thanksgiving Eve, I believe it was. And Paul Yetter, who I'd tried a couple of cases with, asked if I would come over and head up the appellate group. So I did that in Austin for a while and then decided to come back to Houston. We closed our Austin office and came back to Houston, has been practicing appellate law with some trial law as well ever since. So it's been a long time doing different things.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to slight Wendell Hall. He is another person that I consider to be a mentor in my career. And actually, I've been thinking about calling Wendell and trying to get him out of retirement long enough to talk about standards of review.
I was going to say, who's going to update it? Fulbright did update it at one point, and I forget what, and I've got a copy of it, and I refer to it. But I think it's been a number of years since it's been updated. But I don't know who would take on that Herculean task of updating Texas standards of review.
I think it's been updated recently. Wendell passed it off to another lawyer, a small firm lawyer in San Antonio. And I think it pretty much reads the same, Reagan. So Wendell's fingerprints are all over it still. But that was certainly always in development when we were practicing together at Fulbright. But so you're back in Houston, you're with Yoder Coleman, but you're one of those rare birds who has the skills to be both a trial lawyer and an appellate lawyer. As you mentioned, I'd either forgotten or was not aware that you had spent so much time in Illinois trying those big cases. But, we talk sometimes on the show here about the differences between the skill sets that are involved in trial work and appellate work. And you're, I think, in a unique position to offer some opinions on that. What can you share with us there?
Well, it's always the audience you're talking to. And it's different. Talking to a jury is very different from talking to a trial judge, and talking to a trial judge is very different from talking to an appellate judge. So you just have to take those into account. So it's a very different audience. I have a different view also of appellate practice. I tend to think appellate practice is any argument, legal points to a judge. And that includes a lot of things these days, if you think about it. We don't try nearly as many cases as I did when I first started out, and we had workers' compensation cases and minor automobile accident cases that I tried in Fulbright and Jaworski. We don't have those anymore in the big firms, and not much even in medium-sized firms. You just have to have it's a different audience and a different attention to detail in what you're trying to accomplish. With jurors, you're trying to persuade them on the facts, and you've got to develop themes. My partner, Paul Yetter, is wonderful at this, and he uses a lot of visual aids because that's very important to jurors these days. He often suggests that I do that in appellate court, and I tell him no, he needs to go back to trial court because judges are concerned about words, not about pictures. That's not always true, but jurors are a different animal in terms of what you're trying to. It all goes back to Aristotle and the things you do to try to persuade, and you have to look at your audience. Trial judges are also very different because they are looking at trying to do certain things in the trial court and get the case done and over with, and they're not quite as concerned with some of the legal aspects and nuances of the law as they are with practical aspects of getting the case done. When appellate lawyers are working with trial lawyers, I mean, the paramount thing is to get it to the trial judge, get it done on time, get it done quickly, and get it done in a very brief format. A judge that I had a lot of respect for in Beaumont told us on Daubert issues, give me one page that tells me why I should strike this expert, and that was Jim Mahaffey. A lot of defense lawyers didn't like Jim Mahaffey, but I thought he was a very good judge, very innovative. The first electronic docket we had in the state of Texas was in his court in asbestos cases. But I've told that story many times, that trial judges do not have the time to sit there and parse out your sentences and figure out how the subjects and verbs go together and listen to all the eloquent language. They need it very quickly, and they need to be able to digest it very quickly because they don't have a lot of time, particularly in state courts where they have no clerks. So it's a different kind of advocacy there. You're trying to get it done. You're trying to get it done very briefly and very succinctly, and always have a practical about it. If it doesn't make practical sense, it's not going to persuade a trial judge. Appellate, is very, you're worrying about every little jot and tittle in your brief to try to achieve the mythical perfect brief. So it's a little different level of perfection. Just have to do different things.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, Litigation Analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with Litigation Analytics on Westlaw Edge.
To kind of set the stage for where we want to take this conversation, and looking at what civil practice is like from an appellate standpoint, we have here, on the call represented, I'm currently in a solo practice. I've been in a boutique with three or four lawyers practicing civil appeals. As a young lawyer, the first 9 years of my career was spent in a large firm. And Jody is what I would like to characterize as a large firm lifer. He's been with Kelly Hart his whole career. And then Reagan, you've kind of done it all. I think you bring a lot of different perspectives to this conversation, because I guess you haven't been a solo. That may be the one thing you've not done.
No, I've not done that. That would be frightening to me. I have a lot of respect for you, Todd, to be able to do that. That would be that would be frightening.
Well, I appreciate that. But I mean, you've certainly been currently, I would say you're in a boutique firm, a litigation boutique, but y'all do an awful lot of appellate work there. And then you mentioned the firms you've been with before. You know, we might even classify those as giant law firms. We have a lot of different perspectives to bear on the conversation today. And because we get questions sometimes from people who listen to the show, and that's really kind of what drove this, was folks wanting to hear sort of some practical aspects about civil appellate practice in particular. And what we're going to do, I think, in a subsequent episode or two, we're going to try to focus on government appellate practice and criminal appellate practice. But for today, what we have basically is, you know, pretty much the gamut covered on civil appellate practice with a number of years of experience here. And so one thing that, you know, even going back to like law students or young lawyers, things that they often ask is, how do I become an appellate lawyer? And that can be, of course, in any practice setting. And of course, the sort of standard advice that folks have been given on this show before is, well, do well in law school, become editor of the Law Review if you can, and do a judicial clerkship. There's some advantages, disadvantages to state versus federal clerkships. And then, you know, go out and do good work and then develop your appellate practice. Well, so let's assume that, you know, someone has done all that and they've managed to land a job. Let's maybe start with the large firm setting. And maybe the two of you could kind of opine about, how does one, you know, become an appellate practitioner, a civil appellate practitioner going into a large law firm? Because that seems to be what people want to do a lot of times, folks who've come out of judicial clerkships. And they find it increasingly difficult to accomplish.
Jody, you want to lead off on that?
Sure. You know, I think if you want to get your foot in the door to do appellate work at a big law firm, and I kind of use big maybe a little bit differently than Todd. I think our law firm is about 150 people. Our appellate group is a little bit more like a boutique. I think we have about 8 people that do primarily appeals. But I think the clerkship is a good way to go, whether it's federal or state, because I think that sort of sets your resume apart. But in terms of actually doing the appellate work, I think that certainly indicates to people that's what you want to do. But I'm not sure that's the only way to get there, because I actually didn't do a clerkship. I guess I would like to say maybe appellate practice kind of found me. And I mean that a little bit literally. I started doing just litigation at Kelly Hart right out of law school and thought that's what I wanted to do. And then a couple of years after I started, I'd worked on maybe a couple of appeals, but nothing major, you know, wrote a section of a brief here or there. And then I say it found me because David Keltner joined the firm and came into my office one day and said, "Hey, I've got this thing coming up. You want to come help me do some research on an appellate issue?" And I said, "Sure, why not?" And started working on that and realized that I really liked it and liked working with David. And, you know, it kind of blossomed into an appellate practice. I don't think I understood at the time what exactly the difference between an appellate and a trial practice was. I thought, you know, you litigate, you do that stuff, and then you make similar arguments on appeal, but I didn't realize the nuances that went into it, and kind of have discovered that and realized that, I think to your point, Reagan, I really like talking to judges. That really, I think, is where my strengths lie. Not that I've tried a couple of cases. I still do stuff in trial courts, but it's more, I think, the appellate practice you talked about, which is the legal issues, the going to trial and helping with the jury charge, doing error preservation stuff, you know, that line of things, rather than being the one that gets up and does the actual voir dire, the one that's taking the witnesses. You know, one thing I would say to people who want to do it at a larger firm is, I wouldn't cabin yourself off. I think it's great to let people know you want to do appeals. I think if you can be part of whatever is called an appellate section at the firm you want to be at, I think that that's great. But or don't turn down litigation, because I think it's important to do both, really. And all of our appellate partners, and I know all of our associates that come in, we make sure that they get litigation work alongside appellate. I don't think coming in off of a clerkship is really enough experience to qualify you to only do appellate law. I think you need to get down into the trial courts, be in the trenches a little bit, and see what it's like. Because it's very easy, I think, as an appellate lawyer to look and say, oh, they should have done this differently. They should have done this differently. But if you haven't been there and seen, I think to Reagan's point, the just kind of split second calls of, look, yeah, I can preserve this error. It's going to make the judge mad. It's going to irritate the jury. And is it really worth, at the end of the day, doing that to make this point that I might raise and probably am not going to get reversed on appeal. And I think until you've really sat down and seen those calls having to be made and been part of them, it's hard, I think, to understand from an appellate perspective what goes into that. So I guess that's my advice is, you know, if you want to do appellate work, I think make that clear, but recognize that trial work is really important to be a good appellate lawyer. And I think even if you don't want to do appellate work, doing a little bit of it, if you really want to be a trial or a litigation person, is also important because you have to understand kind of where it's going. And seeing the trial process through and knowing how to do that is incredibly important. But knowing how the Court of Appeals looks at things and the things that they look for in the record, and frankly, just reading your own records of trials is really important because the way it sounds in your head, it looks a lot different on paper. So that was my long rambling answer.
Well, that's a great answer, Jody. I think that's spot on. You know, I had the benefit when I was hired at Fulbright, being specifically assigned half to the appellate section and half to the litigation section. And I wouldn't trade for the opportunity that I had to do litigation work at a firm like that. It was a great litigation shop, had a renowned litigation training program. I got the benefit of going through that. And I do give Fulbright a lot of credit for giving me that experience and also letting me have a hand in appellate matters. And because in a large firm, and I hear your point about, 150 lawyers is not necessarily what a lot of folks would consider to be a large firm. But at a large firm, I think those appellate jobs have kind of become a rarer thing because clients, I assume, are, they're not so gung-ho on having a first-year associate, take the lead on handling an appeal, especially if it's a large, corporation client with a lot at stake. Reagan, I know you do a lot of that sort of bet the company kind of high value dollar cases. What's been your experience that, really in any of your practice settings, but how you've been in a position of bringing up young appellate lawyers? So what advice would you give to someone who's coming out of law school or a judicial clerkship who wants to get into appellate practice?
Well, I think a lot of people think they want to do appellate practice, especially if they come from a clerkship, because that's what they've been doing. And they've been in law school doing research and writing, and they go to a judge and it's an impressive thing. And they see arguments and things like that. And they kind of know they're comfortable in knowing how to do that. So I really encourage people to spend time doing trial work and litigation work before they make a final commitment to appellate, just for the same reasons that Jody is saying. Now, there's certainly some really fine appellate lawyers in Texas and anywhere else who have never tried a case. I understand that. But if you have been in the trenches, you have a better appreciation for really what the important things are and what you have a different level of perfection because you know perfection can never be achieved in the trial court. So I think it's important to see both. And sometimes people will do the trial work and they'll say, oh, I've decided that's what I want to do instead of the appellate. So don't cabin yourself in the beginning. I think at the big firm, you have to be patient. I wanted to do tort work and they put me on a commercial team. So that was fine. And I did that for a while. And that was, I enjoyed that. But eventually I got in the tort team. And at Fulbright, we had teams. And I just was able to handle a few appeals of mine, my own. I think when you demonstrate that you can write very well and research very well, and you can demonstrate that in motion practice and in summary judgment briefing and other things, people will notice that. And they may decide that you really would fit in as an appellate lawyer. But I think you have to be patient about it and also take advantage of all the different opportunities in the big firm of seeing different kinds of practices and different kinds of experiences. That's one of the big advantages, I think, of a big firm, as opposed to just coming into a small boutique where that's all you're going to be doing is the appellate work or the trial work, for that matter. So I just think take advantage of the opportunities and not cabin yourself at the very, very beginning of your practice. You're going to be doing it for a long time. So see some different aspects of the practice. But in terms of how to develop into an appellate lawyer, I think writing is the most important thing that there is. How to express yourself in a way that is very, very clear, gets a point across. And that's really the most important thing in developing the skill to be an appellate lawyer. It's nice to argue, and it's always fun to argue, but it's always a briefing, I think. Unless you concede something on appeal that dooms your case, seldom do you actually win or lose at oral argument, but it's a lot of fun.
And Todd, before we, one other thing that kind of occurred while Reagan was talking, if you feel like you're not getting a shot at appellate work, Texas has a really good appellate pro bono program. And consider that, because it may be your local appellate court has cases. It may be that a court somewhere else in the state has it. And the great thing is there's a lot of resources, particularly now with Zoom and everything, to be able to handle an appellate case from wherever. So think about picking one of those up. If there's not a mentor in your firm or practice, they can help you find one through the bar that will kind of sit on your shoulder and help you if you need it. So think about taking those, because it's a great way, number one, just to get the experience. Number two, several courts I know will guarantee you an oral argument if you're taking a pro bono case, if that's what you want. So, you know, consider that. I wouldn't do it your first year in practice, but if you're a few years in and looking to try it, that's a good way to get some experience.
Sure. We always volunteered for pro bono criminal cases, and most of them didn't get argued, but a couple of them did, and a couple of them made some pretty good law. It was pretty exciting who handled them.
One thing that came to me while Reagan was talking a few minutes ago was that, you know, just because you decide you want to be a trial lawyer or an appellate lawyer, I think I'm thinking about it more from the appellate lawyer side, doesn't mean you won't be doing one or the other, you know, during your career. And I think, Reagan, you're a really prime example of someone whose work has kind of ebbed and flowed in different directions throughout their career. I think you've expressed a preference for the appellate side of things, but, you know, you're, as I mentioned earlier, you're one of those rare birds who is a skilled trial lawyer as well. And to some degree, this is maybe more so the case in a smaller, either boutique or certainly a solo setting, but you may need to adjust your skills according to the work that's put in front of you. I mean, sometimes you've got to handle something for a client. It's not necessarily outside your wheelhouse if you've got the skill to do it, but, you know, you may be led to do more litigation or trial work or more appellate work, depending on what the client's needs are, that especially if you've got that relationship. And I think you're a good example of that.
Yeah, I remember when I first moved into appellate practice, people said, well, he's a trial lawyer. He doesn't do appellate work. And then after doing appellate work for quite a while, I started doing some trial work again. They said, well, he's an appellate lawyer. He doesn't do trial work. So have to be a little patient. And, you know, I think it's important. You know, when I switched into appellate full time, I made sure that I went to the big appellate seminars, and we have such great seminars in Texas. I would go to both of them, the state bar and the UT, you know, main seminars, and get involved and get around people who are doing appellate work and find out what's going on. That's one of the big problems I see in all the CLE that's being done now, and really even before COVID, people doing everything online and looking at the videos. You learn so much by going there and talking to people and making a presence there. So if you're interested in appellate, go to the big appellate seminars, learn things, talk to people. That's the one way to kind of get involved in the appellate practice.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. One thing that I thought we might talk about is, you know, what happens when you change your practice settings? You know, Reagan, you've moved big firm to boutique. I've moved around big firm to solo, to boutique to solo, you know, and how that affects your workload and the way that you approach your cases. I think as far as the solo side of things, you know, I guess you could offer an alternative to someone who's in a larger firm that if appellate work is really what you want to do, and you're not getting the opportunities that you think you should or that you want, and you're well enough qualified and you've got a decent amount of experience to go out and market yourself as an appellate lawyer, then you can do what I did and hang your shingle. But that is not everyone has the stomach for that, especially in today's market, because it, you know, I'll be the first to say that it is hard work to get if you aren't already fairly established as someone who does that kind of work. Now, you know, there might be niches that you could fill, such as if you were doing a decent amount of plaintiff's work and You had some good relationships with the plaintiff's bar. You might be able to fill a role there, but you know, there are, I guess, consequences that come along with that, which mostly along the lines of, you know, how you get paid. But Reagan, did you tell much of a difference when you were moving between large and boutique kind of firms about how those firms approached appellate practice?
How they approached appellate practice, I didn't see a lot of difference there. You, in a large firm, of course, naturally, you get, I think, more work from inside the firm because there's a lot going on. A lot of things or cases are tried or things are handled or you have mandamuses or you have sanctions hearings and things like that. So there's a lot going on. And it also depends on whether the firm you're with, and I think a lot of them nowadays, have the appellate lawyer going along with the trial lawyers to the trial to help out. But in terms of the overall practice, no, I remember going to Yetter Coleman's Austin office and realizing there really wasn't a library. That was a big shock to me. A big firm with big library. So I had to learn a little bit more about how to get resources without all the books around me. And of course, now people probably don't go to libraries, even if they're there. So it's a different, there've been a lot of changes in how we practice back because of the technology, which I think actually helps smaller firms and solos and boutiques more because you don't need to have all the infrastructure, if that's the right word, to practice. And Todd, actually, knowing a fair number of appellate lawyers all over the country, I would say there's a lot more solo appellate practice in other states than there is in Texas. You see a lot of solo appellate practitioners in other states. And one reason is because they don't have conflicts at all in a solo practice, or virtually none. But you see a lot of solo practitioners in other states. Texas has been a little bit different, I think, in the way the big firms have previously emphasized the appellate practice along with their trial practice.
That's interesting to hear. Of course, you know, it's very possible to make a good living as a solo appellate lawyer once you get yourself established. And you're exactly right. You know, for the longest time, I pretty much kept my conflicts in my head, but so much time has gone by, I can't rely on that anymore. But your point too, Reagan, about resources, I think that really captures this issue, which is, you know, in a large firm, typically you're going to have just an abundance and almost an embarrassment of riches resource-wise. And then as you scale down smaller in size, that's going to necessarily decrease because those overhead items are not something that you're going to be able to justify. But you're also correct, and this is something that I've emphasized when I talk on different topics, that, you know, the legal tech that's available out there now, you don't need a library. You know, I can practice with my laptop and maybe a printer if I'm going to print something out, but maybe not. And the most important thing to my practice besides a laptop is a fast internet connection. That and my Westlaw subscription. I think I pretty much have all the tools I need. I can go on the road for a year. And as long as the work was there, I could get it done. Of course, that's the tricky part, right? It's keeping the pipeline full.
Yes. Yes, as I often say, a lot of the time we have too much work to do, so we have anxiety about getting it done. And then when we don't have enough work, we have anxiety about where the work is coming from. So the only constant is anxiety.
That is very true.
And I do, some days I do miss the days at the big firm where I could, you know, show up to work and have work to do. But you reach a certain point in your career and more is expected of you.
Well, Todd, let me ask you a question if I could.
Absolutely.
In a solo practice, you know, one of the things about the, you know, even the boutique practice is you have a lot of people you can talk to about things. You can go down the hall. Well, we can't go down the hall right now, which is a problem with COVID, but you know, you have people you can bounce things off of and talk to. And I usually handle appeals with one other person. You know, we don't put a whole bunch of people on an appeal because I don't think you need that. But what do you do to fill, I mean, you had years at Fulbright, obviously, where you had a lot of camaraderie with other lawyers and talked about things. So how do you do that in the solo practice?
Well, up until pretty recently, you mentioned COVID, you know, I would sublease an office from another law firm, and I had the ability, at least gave me some socialization. I didn't just stay in my office and work all the time or work from home. That was good, but of course I couldn't really talk through details of my cases with lawyers who weren't in the same firm as me. It is a challenge. You have to develop, I think, a comfort level with your own ability, because you don't have that ability to go and kick ideas around. And that's certainly something that, you know, is a common issue with solos. You might could speak in generalities, or, you know, go into one of the lawyer Facebook groups and give a hypothetical, or maybe, you know, appellate Twitter is another good resource, you know, but I think you have to be cautious about revealing confidences and revealing strategy. And so it does make a solo practice, Reagan, you know, a little more lonely, because you can kick ideas around with your trial lawyer. And it's also, you know, fairly common, though, that your trial lawyer may disagree with you. And I think that happens across practice settings, right? It doesn't matter what setting you're in. And so, you know, whether you're dealing with a trial lawyer as a solo practitioner, or you're dealing with a trial lawyer or client and working in a large firm or a boutique, you know, part of your job is to advocate, you know, for your conclusion. And so you're doing the same basic task, you know, regardless of which setting that you're in. You have a client in every setting, and who that client is kind of varies a little. But it is an issue, and I won't deny that. But if you've got enough confidence to be out on your own and feel sure of your ability, and, you know, it really helps to have, I think, most of my relationships are with trial lawyers. And it really helps to have a good relationship with the trial lawyer and be able to explain, because all that really does is it reinforces, you know, my confidence in my own thinking about strategy on a case, for example, or research. And so, that is something that is definitely an advantage in another firm where you're practicing, you know, among like-minded people who totally understand what it is you're doing. And maybe even, as you point out, Reagan, working with you on the file, you know, that's really an advantage to being able to kick those kinds of issues around in non-COVID times when you're just down the hall. Some of what I was just saying does kind of get into the question of among different practice settings, you know, where the work comes from, because that's ultimately the issue, is whether you're a solo or in a boutique or in a large firm, you know, you don't want to have that anxiety of not having work to do. And so I thought we might talk a little bit about, you know, in those various settings, like where work comes from. I know there's probably no real generalization, because I'm sure it comes from lots of different sources. I can speak to my own experience, but I think, you know, for folks that are interested in getting into either a boutique or a more of an established firm setting, are there any general observations that either one of y'all can offer on that?
Jody, you want to take that first?
Sure. You know, I have said it, and I'll probably say it a couple more times. I feel like our little appellate group within a larger firm really is a little bit more appellate boutique-like. And the reason I say that is I think most of our business on appeals comes from outside the firm, which is not to say that we don't do appeals for people inside the firm, but I think the majority of cases I work on come to us not necessarily as the firm that tried the case, and sometimes not even the firm that handled the intermediate court of appeals proceeding. So it's a lot of that. And I think as a generalization, I can say this about civil appellate practice: unless you have a pretty large client, you don't get necessarily a lot of repeat clients, or you do, but maybe it's a few years in between. I mean, we have some institutional clients that give us repeat appellate business that are kind of larger companies, corporations that have a lot more litigation, but so much of, I think, our work at our firm, and I think it's probably the same for y'all, comes really from referrals from trial lawyers, because they're the ones that you get the relationship with, and they're the ones that try a lot of cases. So they may have a client that has an appeal, and it may be the only appeal that client ever has, or maybe once every 5 to 10 years that client has an appeal. And I think I'm kind of lucky with the size of our firm that we do have some flexibility on rates that maybe the big kind of giant firms don't have. And so I think we can do work for the larger institutional clients, but at the same time, you know, I do a fair amount of work for some individuals, some, you know, smaller kind of closely held businesses, and we do some insurance work too. And so it's kind of nice to have that flexibility, because you don't get pigeonholed on a certain type of case or client, which has been interesting.
But business development is very difficult for appellate lawyers. You can't just do a cold call or go out to a client and say, well, got any good appeals lately? I mean, they always have disputes and issues, need to send out a demand letter, need to respond to a demand letter, need to evaluate whether we have a claim here or not, or whether the other party has a claim. And those things come up almost every day for some companies. But appeals, you know, it's usually after you have a trial, which doesn't happen as often as it used to occur, then they have a bad result and they're looking for somebody to help them. And, you know, part of what you said, Jody, is even trial lawyers who try very good cases, you know, you lose sometimes. And when you lose, there's a tendency for the client to go to a different firm for the appeal, or at least to affiliate another firm into the appeal. So that may be one reason why in some situations you get a lot of referrals outside the firm. So you basically have to kind of wait for something to happen to have an appeal come up, and then they start looking for appellate lawyers. And I agree with you. It's very important to have relationships with trial lawyers. And we can get a little insular as appellate lawyers. We can just talk to our own selves at our own seminars and feel like we know everything, and we can talk about Oxford commas and all sorts of things that are very interesting to us and have no importance to other people. But, you know, if you can speak at a trial lawyer event, CLE, that's more important, because that's people say, oh, yeah, that lawyer had some interesting things to say. And then sometimes you'll get a call, as I did recently, from a lawyer out in West Texas who just had a question. And so I probably will never get anything from him, but who knows? And so I spent some time answering his question and talking to him about the problem. And, you know, someday it may turn out to be something that he gets involved in. And he says, well, I recommend that you use this lawyer for the appeal. So I think it's very important. And how you interact with trial lawyers is extremely important, because you can tend to say, well, you didn't do this right. And you got to be very careful with that. Because they are certainly not going to recommend you again if you are highly critical of what they did at the trial practice. Now, you have to be honest with the client about what's going on, and if there's a serious waiver issue, you've got to talk about it. But you don't want to jump the gun, and you don't want to unnecessarily say, well, this could have been done differently, or it should have been done this way. It's always hard to tell whether when it's a judgment call, you know, what the right answer is at trial. And sometimes I've made judgment calls that I think, gosh, that was probably pretty bad. It turns out good. And then made good judgment calls that turn out bad. So you never know what's going to happen in the minds of 12 jurors.
Yeah, you talk about CLE talks, and you're right. We do tend to talk amongst ourselves a lot as appellate lawyers. But I think the nugget of wisdom that I heard and what you were commenting on there, Reagan, was it's a good idea to go where the trial lawyers are. And that's something that it is challenging to do. And as if you're a younger lawyer, you know, how do you do that? How do you go about doing that? And I know, you know, I was always encouraged to get on the speaking and writing circuit as a way to get my name out there, because to get, you know, you have to be exposed to the trial lawyers. They have to know who you are and that you're competent at what you do before they're going to be comfortable, you know, bringing you into a case. It does help, you know, if you're at a firm with a good reputation. I think that makes a big difference. And, you know, we're talking about developing work from outside the firm. Inside the firm, it's, you know, sort of the same thing, but you might get trained up a little bit more within a firm, and they may be, you know, trying to channel certain work to you as a younger lawyer. But that's really, I think, one of the hardest parts is, you know, when you're really getting started and established, getting out there, getting your name out there and making it known, you know, what it is you do and how you can help. And I think that's really the best piece of advice is just, you know, make those friendships with trial lawyers, because as we've pointed out, you know, a lot of clients, even institutional clients, appeals may be a one-time thing for them. But if you're friends with the trial lawyer, they're the ones who are in the courtroom trying cases. They may need help on their summary judgment motions. And the best trial lawyer clients are the ones who don't mind if you know, they know that you may be in a position to pull their feet out of the fire, and know that they might not be the best person to deal with an appeal, or maybe they know that they don't have the objectivity. I think that's a little rarer, because people you hear all the time, well, I tried the case, I should be the one to handle the appeal, I know the facts better than anyone else. And my typical response to that is, yeah, the facts are not the most important thing in an appeal. I mean, that's all really good advice.
I know when I was in Illinois trying cases, and I was also my charge was to try cases, not settle them, try them, and then we're going to try to change the law on appeal. That was our strategy. So I was the appellate lawyer as well. But I also, when I go out of state, I always make sure I have some appellate lawyer in that jurisdiction who's helping me, because you can never know all the rules, even though I'm actually licensed in Illinois, became licensed. But I would get feedback from him because I would, you know, as I say, as a trial lawyer, you know the case from the inside out. The appellate court sees it from the outside in, and that's the way an appellate lawyer looks at it. So it's very hard to change that perspective when you've tried the case, because you remember all these things that happened and how they happened, and they may not make one whit of difference to how, what happens on the appeal. So you lose some objectivity, and you also assume things that you know so well that may not be clear to the appellate court. So you really have to watch that.
Well, one other aspect, I think this crosses over, you know, across different practice settings, certainly, is how to work with clients, how to deal with clients, and different client expectations. My recollection as a young lawyer in a large law firm, Reagan, was, you know, the client didn't know who I was early on, especially on those big, you know, pharmaceutical cases that we were working on. And that changed some over time as you kind of grow up in a law firm. And of course, you know, in a solo setting, it's a little different. You wind up, one of the struggles of a solo or small firm lawyer is being able to detach yourself from being the client's best friend so that you can actually get your work done. I guess there's really probably not a lot of generalities, you know, general observations that we can make about client relationships, other than maybe the young lawyers, I would probably advise them, you know, if they're coming up in a firm to be patient. You know, a lot of young lawyers crave that client contact. It's like they crave, you know, real responsibility on a case or going to court. In that kind of setting, in a mid-sized or larger firm setting, so often what's at stake is just, you know, so much money in civil cases that the client most frequently is going to want to work with someone who has got some level of experience and seniority in the firm. It is a challenge, I would say, and y'all, you know, chime in if you disagree, but it is a challenge, I think, for someone just trying to break in to get a lot of client contact in those settings. But, you know, when you get to a practice setting like mine, you know, as I say, you sort of sometimes have too much client contact. And again, it depends on the client. You know, some clients want to just check in from time to time. And of course, another aspect of our practice is that we go long, long periods of time without anything happening. Mm-hmm. And so if you've got a high maintenance client like that, not a bad thing to be one step removed. Mm-hmm. What do y'all have to say about client relationships?
I think you're right. I mean, everyone is a little bit different. I think for the reasons that Reagan talked about and I mentioned, a lot of times on appeals, you know, if you're young, client contact is not the most important thing to building your practice. I think the most important thing, obviously, is the skill set. You've got to know how to do it and be good at it to really be marketable. But I think the second thing is, you know, the client is the client, and that is who your duty is to. But so often the relationship that brings about the business really is the trial lawyer. And so, you know, if you don't get to spend as much time interacting with a client as a young lawyer as you want to, don't fret about it, because it may be that that's, you know, not someone that is going to be a steady stream of appellate business moving forward. And I think just, you know, getting to know as a young lawyer the people that you work with, particularly if you're in a large firm setting, and forming relationships with the partners and the senior associates that you work with, and letting them know your abilities and the things you're good at, inevitably you're going to move up the ladder and the rope on that, and you're going to get more contact. You're going to get more responsibility because they're going to trust you to represent them and represent the firms in those scenarios. And I think that's where that's going to increase. At least that's kind of my perspective on it.
Well, I think it's important to let the client know what is going on and what to expect. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure both of you have the same thing. I have kind of a letter that tells exactly, you know, how things work in the appellate process and what the steps are and how long it usually takes, and, you know, explain the lengthy petition for review process and the conveyor belt and all that sort of stuff. But it's important to them to know, you know, how it all works, because, you know, they don't always know. And so I think that's one thing is also to create the right expectations. You got to be very you know, clear up front that, well, you know, most appeals don't win if you're the appellate. If you're working against several things that are against you, the standard review, primarily the reversible error concepts. You try to explain that and people don't, lots of times don't understand. And I have clients who are big, you know, big companies and individuals, even in our practice. And it's a different communication to them. Some people kind of understand from the big companies, and individuals don't understand why you can't put in more facts in the Texas Supreme Court to explain why you shouldn't be held liable. So you just got to say, well, you know, the time for that is past. We cannot, you know, call another witness at this point, and just be very, very patient about it. I think you also have to be very sensitive in any kind of setting, including mine today, who is the lead in things. And you don't want people to get the idea that you are trying to force yourself into a lead position in a case if you got a client relationship between somebody else who's on the appeal, and that needs to be preserved, and it's an important thing. So I've got a case right now that the trial lawyer has been extremely successful, and so far it's going to go up on appeal based upon what we did. That's great. And so I'll help out on the brief, but I've made it very clear to him from the very beginning that you're going to be the lead in this. I'm going to help out and I'll give you suggestions. And you always have to figure out what you're supposed to do, what the client wants you to do, and what the trial lawyer is comfortable with you doing, or the other appellate lawyer is comfortable with you doing. So that's always kind of a delicate dance to figure that out. And I think that's important, because otherwise you can create some tension that's not helpful. And if you don't communicate well to a client and give them the right expectations, then that can be a problem too later on.
That's exactly right.
I think large firms, you know, are good about, you've got this sort of messaging that's, you know, you're here's what we have to do to communicate with clients about expectations and all of that. I think it's those who've come up and gone out early into a solo setting, you know, haven't necessarily been indoctrinated that way. And that's a great point, because, you know, one of the, I think, most important things that you do as an appellate lawyer, regardless of your practice setting, is condition your client, set their expectations. And because I'll just advise my fellow solo small firmers, if you're not doing that, you really need to, because that you're setting yourself up for big problems later on down the road if you don't. And, you know, especially if you're not necessarily in agreement with what the trial lawyer is saying to the client about their chances on appeal.
Oh, yes.
You know, sometimes you have to come in, and I don't know the original source of this saying, Reagan, maybe you do, but, you know, I've said it before, you know, sometimes the appellate lawyer's job is to come in and shoot the wounded.
Oh, yeah.
That means giving very realistic advice.
Yep.
And even when it's hard, you know, like you were, you got maybe a waiver issue. Those are the hardest conversations.
Yes,
they are, but they're absolutely critical. And yeah, I agree.
Well, Reagan, I think we've come pretty much to the end of the time we had allocated to visit with you today. And I'm so grateful to you for being willing to come on the show and offer up some of your wisdom and in your many years of practice and different practice settings. And just, you know, thank you again for spending the time with us.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, thank you. Well, before we go, pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@texapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or Instagram @TexapLawPod, or reach out through the podcast's Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at TexapLawPod.com or on Twitter @TexapLawPod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.